sin, insofar as it is evil, certainly cannot. But look at the prodigal son. His fault brought forth an overwhelming compassion from his father, which had been like a sealed-up spring in his heart. You can force sin to bear good fruits in you, the fruits of selfless love, the fruits of pardon. This is what it means to redeem evil, to compel sin to produce good, an increase of love. This is the only legitimate revenge. January 4, 1951. Do not say, "Our marriage has lost its meaning. The image of the union of Christ and the Church has been profaned in us." You are right to return to this great fundamental notion. But precisely under this ideal, your fidelity in response to his infidelity has a magnificent meaning. It is a witness to the unshakable fidelity of Christ which the sin of humanity is not able to discourage. February 17, 1951. I don't love him anymore. I was very surprised to hear you speak this small, terrible sentence. How then are you more faithful than he is? Who knows, maybe he loves you more than you love him. His infidelity may be less serious than yours, it may be only weakness of the flesh, while yours would be weakness of the heart. I say would be because I refuse to believe that you no longer love him. I think, moreover, that you are going to discover what true love is. Or rather, your love until now has been true, but your new love will have a rarer quality. It will spring from disinterestedness, from free self-giving. I would like to see you admit to yourself that you have at least 5% of the wrong of what has happened on your side. Your attitude in regard to your husband would then be more just, I think. Did you try to please him every day? Did you make the effort to defend him against himself? Were you jealous, not with the jealousy of egoism, which is a sickness of the heart, but with that jealousy of love which is the desire to protect the being whom you love, the ambition to see him great? I have wondered also, since our last conversation, if you have not forced him, in the sense that we say a gardener forces a plant. Have you not constrained him during the years to be what you wanted him to be, to conform to the ideal which you had of the ideal husband, an ideal which you wanted him to embody? And so, one day, he felt the need to shake off this tutelage. What is surprising in that? April 21, 1951. Do not let this time of distress make you neglect the others around you who have need of you. With them, at all costs, save face, or rather, save what is within. Cultivate in yourself that peace which is the fruit of pardon, of selflessness, of prayer, of attachment to God. Save your equilibrium, that is the only way to save face, to put on a good front. It is no less true that sometimes, in the hours of stress, saving face is the only way to save yourself. Do not be like the women who recount to their friends, confidentially, the conjugal scenes which they play. You will sap the strength of your soul, and will not know how to resist the temptation to gratify the feeling of rancor and spitefulness. And the more you gratify them, the worse they get. June 16, 1951. Guard yourself against the attitude which would treat this as a contest. War is declared, of which my husband is the prize. One battle has been lost, it is true, but it was not a fair fight, it was won by treachery. I will beat my opponent yet. Resignation would be no better. Be distrustful of this demon at your side who tempts you to give up your suffering, and who presses you to blind yourself to what is admirable in your husband, who invites you to regard his wrongdoing and faults with bitter and cold detachment, to keep score, as it were, and to add up your complaints. This reaction of withdrawal into piety is very close to resignation. It is frequently a search for compensations. It is also the desire to save wounded pride. To dwell on the good reasons one has to be scornful of both sin and sinner is to esteem oneself. It is only one step away from not desiring the return of the husband, in order to safeguard this image of the woman who has been courageous and edifying in her hour of trial. It is only one step away from discouraging his attempts to return, even before they are made, to stop on his lips the confession, the confidence, the word which would re-establish contact. To safeguard their moral comfort, some women take as much trouble to avoid what would make them agreeable in the eyes of their husbands as they once displayed in seeking ways to please him. It is in your sacrament of marriage that you will find the graces necessary to avoid these snares. You must have recourse to it. You will be able to draw from it the strength to cross the distance between love and charity. This transition must be one of the principal results of your trial. Most certainly your love for him was not a stranger to charity, but it remained too human. It is time that it became charity, the love of Christ in you for your husband. It is a transmutation which is not made without pain. But here precisely is one meaning of the drama which you are living. July 21, 1951. Let there be no reprisals. Do not lower the iron curtain. If you refuse him the sight of your soul, the best of you, you bar the way of return. For him to love you, he must be able to admire you. Remember the experience of the woman who reconquered her husband by revealing to him the life of grace being born again in his soul. Do not think that you have the right to refuse your interior life to your husband. Do not preach to him, but be attentive to silences, which are always like a door opening. September 12, 1951. Strive to see the best in him. Men, like children, end up resembling the image which you make of them. If you stubbornly keep your esteem and confidence in him, cost what it may, there is every chance that he will become worthy of this esteem and this confidence, having recognized in your eyes what he wishes to become. Believe him if one day he assures you that it is all over. Do not say, as did one woman I know, "Prove it to me." It would be better to deceive yourself by having confidence in him which is not merited than to refuse to him the confidence which he has merited. I have every reason to hope that the end is near, but I must counsel you just the same to expect the crisis to be prolonged. Prepare yourself, then, for a long patience, and if it is not necessary, give thanks to God. October 2, 1951. I reproach myself for still not having had the courage to speak to you of this other woman, of the enemy, as you call her. You blame her as though all the wrong were on her side. But perhaps your husband has heavy responsibilities in this regard. Do you feel responsible with him? Recall to you the implacable words of Christ, "They are like a red-hot iron." But such an iron not only burns, it also cauterizes. But I say to you, love your enemies, and pray for those who persecute you, in order that you may be true sons of your Father who is in heaven. Yes, you must love her, this other, and pardon her. February 1, 1952. It seemed to me as I listened to you that you were reacting as though a parenthesis in your two lives must now be purely and simply closed. As though all that happened which caused you so much pain, and which, without doubt, caused him so much pain, must be forgotten, conjured away. But nothing is ever utterly abolished. You cannot act as if what has happened, has not happened. From everything, even evil, good must come. Believe me, when he is in possession of himself, and I have no reason to doubt that that will be soon, he will have acquired a new maturity. There are other ways besides weakness which lead to the rebirth of the soul. But weakness also, when one triumphs over it by humility and courage, is an occasion for maturity. You will see his love for you and his love for God stronger and more mature, after the storm, than before. Chapter 4. The Search for God. The Search for God. I do not remember any more who wrote, "It has been a long time since religion has had anything to do with God," nor what observations inspired this reflection, but I wonder if he would have changed his mind in the course of a visit to a Christian home. What could he learn of the God of the Christians by assisting at their common prayers, observing the attitude of the family during the blessing of the children, or watching the parents instruct and correct? Would he have the feeling of a presence? Before the sign of the cross of these Christians would he discover the grandeur, unknown to him, of the soul which adores? Suppose that he senses a great mystery of love between husband and wife, between parents and children, would he also sense a mystery of love between God and the members of this home? In such a home life is pure, right, generous, but does that testify in the eyes of the visitor to the holiness of God, or simply to an admirable moral philosophy? True, Christ is spoken of there, the children prepare the crib of the infant Jesus, but seeing them and hearing them would you suspect? 75. That the infant in the crib is the God of infinite majesty by whom was made everything that was made. Many Christian homes have only an inferior idea of God. This poverty is revealed by the formalism of religious gestures, by a facile attitude of prayer, by a life in part secularized. How far we are from that generation of those who sought the face of the God of Jacob, mentioned so often in the Psalms. A change is necessary. You must carry on in your homes the search for God. No doubt that requires renewed efforts, but in a world where we wear ourselves out seeking so many things, isn't it right that the Christian be able to say with the author of Proverbs, "I have exhausted myself in seeking to know God"? Parents and children must be curious about God, tracing the divine name in the heavens on beautiful summer nights, the heavens declare the glory of God, and finding him in creation, in the course of a walk through the woods and fields, O Lord our God, how admirable is thy name in all the earth. Alongside the great poem which is the universe, the Bible, Old and New Testaments, should be the preferred reading of the Christian home in quest of the glories of the eternal God and the confidence of his love. Over the course of the centuries the Bible has been the teacher of the adorers in spirit and in truth, because the splendors of the all-powerful are woven into every page. Whoever assiduously and humbly frequents the Bible becomes famished for God, and who can be sated with seeing the glory of God? It pleases me to imagine the home where parents and children live under the regard of the eternal God, meditating on his perfection, in the book of nature and in the Bible. They will raise up a race of red-blooded children. Their virtues respond to the divine perfections which they contemplate, adoration, to the glory of God, childlike confidence, to the love of the Father, abandonment, to his providence, obedience, to his sovereignty, praise, to his splendors. Crops do not grow away from the sun and neither do virtues away from the eternal light. Let us assist at the night prayers of this home which adores God. We notice a preference for the great theological prayers, Our Father, who art in heaven. Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace to men of good will. We praise thee. We bless thee. We adore thee. We glorify thee. We give thee thanks. Holy, 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 Lord God of hosts, the heavens and the earth are full of thy glory. My soul magnifies the Lord. All ye works of the Lord, bless the Lord. Under this roof, they willingly return to the Psalms again and again to express their feelings for the Most High, and to pray in the communion of the whole Church. Notice those who live in this house, adoration and love inspire everything, work and play, meals and sleep. There is no longer anything merely profane, everything is holy, everything is consecrated to God, as Saint Paul demanded, therefore whether you eat or drink, or do anything else, do all for the glory of God. Yet it is not constrained but the joyous freedom of the children of God which reigns in this family. A zeal for the glory of God possesses these souls. This adoring home is an apostolic home. Is it not a spontaneous reaction of those who admire to sing of their wonder, and to recruit others for their choir of praise? How could they be resigned to a lack of love of God on the part of their contemporaries, and not share with Our Lady and all the saints the burning impatience of Christ for manifestation of the glory of the Father? The homes where God reigns prepare the people who will recognize his sovereignty. Christ calls me. Catholicism is a creed, a conception of man and the world, a moral law, an assembly of people, a cult, a history.